The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still, to a large extent,
live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Stephen Cleese is a professor of international education policy at the University of Maryland. He did his PhD at Stanford University in economics, and he is the co-editor of the World Bank in Education. He is the author of the upcoming book, The Conscience of a Progressive. And that book is coming out from Zero Books in October. Stephen, welcome to this video live stream.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
So, you know, to start with, I want to ask you about your background in economics and how it led you to become a progressive. What school of economics did you study and do you teach? And how does that match up with a progressive sensibility or progressive politics?
Well, I could say a lot, but you'll stop me if I go on too much. I mean, I studied economics at Stanford University. I was in the business school and the economics department in a joint program between the two. And I was there from 68 to 73, so it was the Vietnam War era, an era of critique. But basically, as all economics departments in this country still are, it was a neoclassical economics department. Neoclassical economics being the free market economics underlying capitalism. And so that's what I was educated in. We had as many economics departments do, we had one critical left neo-Marxist economist, John Gurley. The students were more critical, but my education was solidly neoclassical economics, which from graduate school on seemed problematic.
So when you say neoclassical, do you mean, would Keynes fit into the neoclassical side of economics?
Yes. I mean, neoclassical economics was the term used by Alfred Marshall in the late 1800s as a synthesis of the political economists who had gone before. Not Marx, obviously, but Smith, Ricardo Malthus, and others. And that has hardly changed since the 20th century. It is the story of a highly competitive, in its limit, what they call perfectly competitive market economy, and how it is economically and socially efficient, and what role government should play. Neoclassical economics are divided to some extent between conservative and liberal. And the conservatives are the ones who are today called neoliberals, especially by their critics. Mm-hmm. And the liberals are more Keynes-oriented, and the conservatives are more Milton Friedman-oriented. The conservatives or neoliberals are the ones who firmly believe that the state should intervene as little as possible, that the market is the solution to most social problems, whereas the liberals from the 1930s in this country to the 70s in this country dominated and argued that you needed a lot of state intervention to correct the inefficiencies and inequities of capitalism. Neoliberals really took over in 1980, and today the same courses I took in what public sector economics should be in today's neoclassical economics departments, which are just all economics departments, is mostly oriented towards privatization, not a role for government, a role to privatize government. I mean, you're supposed to let the market run and survive on its own, but actually we have a corporate welfare state in our country and in many other countries.
What about the claims that someone might make around the idea that the recession of the 70s had demonstrated a limit to Keynesian spending and a need to roll back wages in the welfare state in order to maintain profitability for major economies and companies and so on?
Yeah, I'm not well versed in that area, but what I've seen is strong disagreement among economists. The conservatives say what you just said. The liberals say Keynesianism worked fine. That, you know, you needed fiscal policy and you needed more government spending to get us out of the recession in that era, and it wasn't forthcoming. But you know, there's certainly no consensus among economists that Keynesianism wasn't working. That isn't what got us neoliberalism. It was an ideology shift. When I was in graduate school, about 2 years into 4 years of economics courses, they taught us something called second best theory. First best is a perfectly competitive economy, an idealized state. This is held by both liberal and conservative economists, Friedman followers, Keynesian followers. The idea of second best theory, the idea of second best theory, mm-hmm. is that if you have one imperfection in this idealized, perfectly competitive system, one monopoly, and everything else is perfectly competitive, the economy is not efficient. You don't know how close it is to efficiency. I was thunderstruck when they taught us that. One day, out of 4 years of economics courses, the idea behind neoclassical economics, Keynesian or Friedman, is rooted in this idea of perfect competition. Perfect competition is this ridiculous theory that every economist knows it doesn't hold, but they think it's good enough that you can get testable predictions out of it, and it's good enough that it lets you to believe that a capitalist economy is efficient. Second best theory says that's nonsense. So from graduate school on, I realized that neoclassical economics was fundamentally flawed in theory. And the flaws in practice are obvious. The flaws in practice are we live in a world of unbelievable poverty and inequality. Capitalism is the most inefficient system ever invented. It leaves billions of people at its margins without decent work, without employability, without livelihood, sometimes barely surviving. So my critique of neoclassical economics is both the theory is bankrupt and the practice is obviously disastrous. And that's true of as much of Keynesianism as it is of Milton Friedman's version of it. I mean, perfect competition is this this medieval idea of the gender of angels. I mean, it says you've got nobody can affect price. You've got perfect information. You've got every transaction is closed. It only affects the people who are buyer and seller. If you asked an economist to explain what efficiency is, you would get your eyes would start rolling, because it's almost impossible to explain what an economist means by efficiency. It's a state of overall society in which no one can be made better off without somebody be made worse off. What the hell does that mean? And you know, nobody has any way to talk about that sensibly. So the whole idea of efficiency of a market is bankrupt. Not the idea that markets work, but the idea that nobody can be made worse off without anybody being made better off. says that there's, you know, it's trying to separate this idea of efficiency from equity. And there is no separation. Every decision means some people gain and some people lose. There's no decision in which society as a whole is better off. That's what efficiency is about. Society as a whole is better off. And no. There is no society as a whole. I mean, there is, but there's not in the economic sense of it that nobody loses. Everybody always loses. And so everything we do is a trade-off between some people gaining and some people losing. And economics is about talking about that. That's what it should be about. But the problem is in neoliberal capitalism to me, I mean, neoliberalism is the worst side of capitalism. In the 60s and 70s, at least you talked, you know, it was well recognized that capitalism yielded inequalities and inefficiencies that you needed government to do something about. The market shouldn't rule. And we've had 40 years of the market rules, of market fundamentalism. It's insanity. And it's all the major problems we have, from environmental destruction to poverty and inequality to nuclear war, are fed by these structures of militarization, of inequality, of marginalization, of feeling superior, of denigrating others. And that's why education is so important.
So the book that's coming out in October is The Conscience of a Progressive. And it was it was a response to a response. It was a response to Barry Goldwater's book, The Conscience of a Conservative, which was Paul Krugman's book, A Conscience of a Liberal. So now you're going one more step to the left and writing The Conscience of a Progressive in response to both those books. Can you tell me how you would summarize the morality of conservatism, or the conscience of conservatives, and then liberals, and then progressives?
Yeah, the way I'm using conservative or neoliberal, I mean, Goldwater was a believer in, you know, in individual liberty, in the supremacy of liberty. Government was overstepping its bounds and needed to be controlled. I mean, needed to be shut down, essentially. And I think that there are many people who have a conservative ideology who see liberty as their primary focus. And, you know, that liberty is in part economic liberty. It's freedom to start businesses, the freedom to send your kids to private schools, the freedom to not be regulated. And I don't know what liberalism is. I talk about conservative liberals and progressives as ideological perspectives. So the conservative perspective is focused on liberty. The liberal perspective for me is focused on liberty, but tempered by the need to do collective work, to overcome the excesses of untrammeled markets, untrammeled freedom. And so, as I was saying earlier, liberals recognize that left to its own markets will yield inefficiencies and inequities and major, major ones. And for me, progressives recognize that, would agree with liberals that markets cause those inefficiencies and inequities, but that the solutions are not simply better policies. I mean, the problem with better policies is that they're always co-opted. I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but this world is run by a neoliberal ideology. And you know, these people get together, the World Economic Forum, the Trilateral Commission. I mean, how many people today actually even heard of the Trilateral Commission? But it's all these industrialists and politicians who get together and go back to their own countries and promote neoliberal policies that are in their interests. And progressives argue that, to me, the progressive view is that we have to confront structures, and that's not easy. It's not easy to change structures. Simply having good intentions and good new policies are not going to do it. And that's why there's a lot of hope for social movements among progressives, that this is not simply an intellectual exercise. This is an exercise in democratic movements to change the world, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the anti-globalization, or as they like to say, the alter-globalization movement, the untouchable movements in India, the landless movements in Brazil. I mean, you have people struggling to change this, to make a sea change in how we see the world. And I'm an optimist. I've been to the World Social Forum a couple of times, in which, in opposition to the World Economic Forum, you've got all these grassroots groups coming together and working together and exchanging information and going back, and, you know, there are hundreds of thousands who meet, and they work with millions back home. I mean, I've been very fortunate. I've worked in dozens of countries. Mm-hmm. And in every country I've worked in, I've found people who believe in the slogan of the World Social Forum, that another world is possible. And they're struggling for that. So to me, progressives are struggling to make a sea change in the way the world functions.
So if you could imagine the reader who most needs a copy of your book, who would you imagine it might be?
I think most of my readers will be progressives. And I think they've got something to learn there too, because I really cover a lot of territory. I mean, I look at education, which is I only look at education in depth because that's my area. Mm-hmm. But I look at education, I look at international development, I look at economics, I look at poverty and inequality, I look at big issues like healthcare, I look at environment, I look at war and violence. I also am looking at intersections with gender, race, ethnicity. So I think there's a lot of meat there for progressives to consider on how we work together. But who I hope reads it are conservatives and liberals. Because one of the things I've tried to do in my entire career is not create straw persons, but to try and give an insider's view to views I don't agree with. So I try to do a fair job in my book of expressing what conservatives and liberals think about all of those issues. You know, the conservative approach to education is that public schools are a monopoly. We need competition. They're not efficient. They're failing poor people. They're failing the most marginalized. You have huge inequalities. You've got the achievement gap. And so for conservatives, vouchers make sense. Privatization of schooling makes sense. Charter schools make sense. Parental choice makes sense. What they miss is that, you know, we're all in this together. You can't have an atomized, privatized school system. Schools are the biggest melting pot. Schools are what bring us together. I mean, the reason vouchers were used in this country was after the Supreme Court Brown versus Board of Education decision, the southern states closed their public schools, gave vouchers to everybody so they could attend racist, white supremacist schools. So, you know, we need good public schools. We wouldn't have private schools if we put our resources into good public schools. And we would have better public schools if people came to school ready for school. But so many people come to school deprived. I mean, around the world, something like one third of the children in the world are stunted from malnutrition. One third of the world. I mean, you know what? We're not giving anybody a fair start. And in this country, we're not doing well either. I mean, inner city schools, schools for disadvantaged children are in bad shape. And, you know, they need resources, they need smaller class sizes, and they need children who are well fed, who have good support at home. So, you know, this idea of sending kids to private schools like that's going to make a difference is nonsense. It's going to make a difference to those people who are rich, who are already sending their kids to private schools, and with vouchers, they no longer have to pay it out of their own pocket. The public sector will pay for them to send their kids to private schools. It's a great deal for them, and it's a lousy deal for the rest of us. On inequality today, the conservative view, it's got a couple of tenets to it. One is, it's not as bad as we think. They always say that. Poverty isn't as bad as we think. People get resources in other ways. Globally, you know, people have food production in their homes or outside in their little lots. So it's not as bad as we think. Secondly, it's getting better over time.
Yeah.
And that time will heal it. And third, you know, it's not my responsibility. You know, I'm not here to save the world. I'm here to worry about my family and mine. So
what about the idea that part of the problem of that's built into inequality is cultural?
Sure.
That you know, there's it's the poor have a culture of poverty.
Yeah.
And I mean, that,
you know, we teach meritocracy, that this is a meritocratic system in which we live. And, you know, it's a lie. You're taught that if you fail in school, it's because of your own failure. It's an individual failure. And it's because the school system is failing them. So it's part of the lie that, you know, you're lazy or you're stupid or you're not willing to put in the effort or the time. I mean, all of those are you know, tropes that many people believe. I think many people recognize that they're not true.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.